I'm going to open in prayer. Now, if you don't feel comfortable praying, I understand that, and don't feel you have to pretend to pray or anything like that. It's just, you know, as a Christian, we can't help ourselves, but to, you know, acknowledge the God we believe in and ask for his help. So I'll just pray a very brief prayer. Feel free just to, you know, listen in. Don't feel, you know, compelled to pray, and then we'll dive into it. Loving Heavenly Father, thanks for all the people you've brought here tonight, and thanks for this great opportunity to think of a very important question and objection. I ask that you help me speak clearly, and we ask that you help each of us here think and process what's been said, but also that it will help us come to think about you and come to know you. In Jesus' name, amen. The problem with Christianity is Christians. I want to lead with an important sorry. I think it's very, very important for Christians when it comes to this objection not to immediately jump on the defensive and come up with all the arguments and the explanations. But first of all, I want to lead with a big sorry, as little as it can mean coming from me here in Hobart in the 21st century. Christians have done horrible things, really nasty things, cruel things, manipulative things, violent things. In the name of Christ, many people have committed all sorts of atrocities and abuses. And in the currents of history, there have been times where in the name of Christ, wars have been fought, empires have been established, people have been oppressed, abused, hurt. Indeed, even those who I would truly want to say are genuine believers, brothers and sisters in Christ, have done things that are shameful and really ought to be publicly acknowledged and repented of. So for what it's worth, I mean, how much can one preacher in Hobart in 2011 really carry the burden of sorry for everyone? But for what it's worth, I want to acknowledge that those things have been done, and they're shameful things, and they ought to be, as a Christian, they ought to be repented of. It's not appropriate for a human being, let alone a Christian, to commit it, right? It's shocking and it's hurtful, and for what it's worth, sorry. I take refuge as a Christian from the fact that God is one who will right the wrongs in this world. And so I see the concept of God as the judgment of God, as the Bible teaches us, and it's actually a message of comfort, because it's saying God will right the wrongs that have been committed in this world and in history, that God's going to do something, and this age and the injustices of this life are not the end of the story. But that God will judge the world is not simply something that God will bring a judgment on the wicked out there somewhere. But it's actually a message that in some ways the harshest passages in the Bible about the judgment of God are directed at the religious. Let me give you this passage from the preaching of Jesus in Matthew chapter 23, a very famous tirade of rebuke against the conservative religious leaders of his day. Jesus said to the crowds and his disciples, Matthew 23 says, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do. For they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the places of honour at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and have men call them rabbi. Woe to you, teachers of the law," Jesus says, "you hypocrites. You clean the outside of the cup of the dish, but inside you are full of greed and self-indulgence. Woe to you, teachers of the law, you snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell?" And so it's actually a key part. Some of Jesus' most ferocious teachings are against those who would claim religious belief, serving the God of the Bible. The Jesus' condemnations are, fear not, God will right the wrongs in this world, even the wrongs committed by the religious. I want to lead with a sorry. The problem with Christianity is Christians. I also want to lead with clarifying what I'm not going to say tonight. I'm not going to deal with the problem with Christianity is the Christian moral code. Some people might want to have accusations against Christianity, but what they've really got a problem with is the Christian teachings about what's right and wrong. You know, you Christians are all hypocrites because you believe that people shouldn't have sex before they get married. Now, what that actually is saying is, I don't like Christianity because it teaches that you shouldn't have sex before marriage. That's a different argument. That's an argument about what you believe is right and wrong, not about hypocrisy. But sometimes in our confusion, we get things mixed up. So we're not addressing the Christian moral code. You might disagree with it, but it might still be right, even though you disagree with it. That's not the question tonight. We're not dealing with Christian doctrine. Oh, you know, the problem with Christians is all the stupid things they believe. The Trinity, how does that make sense? But again, that, you might not agree with it. It still might be right. But either way, that's not what we're addressing here. Nor are we addressing the question, the problem with Christianity is the tendencies that religion belief can have. Religious belief promotes irrationality. Religious belief promotes right-wing politics or something. It might. It might still be true. You know, it might be wrong. But either way, that's not the question we're addressing tonight. Not your problems with the Christian moral code, not your problems with Christian doctrine, not the potential sociological tendencies of Christianity or religion. They're different arguments, and that's a different lecture. Tonight, I want to deal with this question of religious hypocrisy in three kind of modes. The first and most simple goes like this. Christians are daggy or disgusting or immoral. Therefore, I don't like Christianity. That's the aesthetic argument, right? They got dumb shoes. I don't like Christianity. You know, something like that. I met a Christian once. He was grumpy. Hate Christianity. Okay? That's the kind of aesthetic vibe argument. But some people, that's their experience, right? The second goes a little bit deeper. Christians don't practice what they preach. Therefore, Christianity is not credible. You could call this the credibility argument or the deconstructionist argument. How can I dare to listen to them when they don't practice what they preach? They've lost their moral authority to say anything, or spiritual authority to say anything to me. Okay? So there's the aesthetic argument. Christians are annoying, ugly, nasty. There's the credibility argument. Christians are inconsistent, so why should I trust them? Both of those are very emotionally powerful. And I don't know, maybe some of you here, that's really where you've come from. You've had painful experiences from Christians in your past, or you've read or heard about horrible experiences that have captured your imagination, perhaps the massacres in Rwanda, the most Christianized nations in Africa, and yet what a fierce and violent history it had. And that just shocked you so much, or you hear about religious sexual abuse in the church, and that's shocked you, or you've experienced some awful experience in church life or from Christians going through school or uni. And that's really a powerful thing. I just don't like Christians. Or how dare they tell me anything after what they've done to me or done to them. They're both fairly loose arguments, however. They're technically, you could say, ad hominem arguments. They're attacking the person rather than the issue. You know, the problem with what you're saying is your dumb jacket. You might have a dumb jacket and still be saying the right thing. The problem with what you're saying is that you're hypocritical. Well, a hypocrite could still tell the truth. It's just that they're inconsistent. You know, so there's a third version, and that is the problem with Christianity goes like this. Christianity claims to change lives, that people who are filled with the Holy Spirit or come to know the Lord Jesus actually will live differently because of that. However, so that's premise one. Premise two, Christians are morally the same as or worse than everyone else. Premise one, Christianity claims to change life. Premise two, in reality, Christians are the same or worse. Therefore, Christianity is not true. And that's the logical argument, right? And so I want to try and address that with you tonight with a few, those variations. I think I've got 4 points to try and cover them under. And the first, the heading, if you're taking some notes or want something to hang it on, the first response to this argument, the problem with Christianity is Christians, is, I've called it, the problem with humanity is people. Let me read to you from Jesus' teaching, and this comes from Luke chapter 11, the Gospel of Luke chapter 11. Where Jesus is speaking about prayer, and that's neither here nor there, but what he says is, which of you fathers, if your son asks for a fish, will give him a snake instead? Or if he asks for an egg, will give him a scorpion? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? In this teaching, Jesus expresses a presupposition of the Bible that all people, even though we do nice things and give good presents, in my case it's Star Wars Lego to my son, right? And if we, you know, I go travelling and call him up and go, how are you going? And he goes, what are you going to give me when you get home? Well, I love you too. Even though we do nice things and kind things and shout our mates a drink or whatever, still Jesus says we are evil. And that's a consistent teaching through the scriptures. Romans chapter 3 teaches that there is no one righteous, not even one. There's no one who does good, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They've together become worthless. There's no one who does good, not even one. That is, the Bible teaches that the entire human race are flawed or corrupt or rebelled against God or hypocritical, that we're unable to consistently live out our lives now in this world. There was at one point the London Times put out a question, this is in the early 20th century, put out the question of what is wrong with the world, and invited letters to the editor, all sorts of responses. And the shortest response was from a Roman Catholic writer and philosopher, G.K. Chesterton. And his answer to this question, what is wrong with the world, that the Times put out, was quite short. Dear sirs, I am. Sincerely, G.K. Chesterton. And he's spot on. What's wrong with the world? What's wrong with the world today? I am. You are. We are. We all are. We are the problem. Just as much as it's your ABC, it's also your problem, the world that we're in. We all, in that sense. The problem with humanity is people. Beware of passing judgment on others who might annoy you because of their beliefs, because of their convictions, because of their nationality, because of the particular failing they have. But beware on passing judgment on someone else. Know yourself. Jesus taught in another place, judge not lest you be judged. Don't go around picking a speck out of someone else's eye when you've got a log in your own eye. Beware. Know yourself. How different would you be in the great sociological forces and pressures in different situations, in the massacres committed during the Vietnam War, in the massacres of Rwanda, in the silence and inactivity and passivity of many of the Germans during the time of the final solution? How would you go if you were born in a different place, at a different time, with different parents and different experience? How would you go? Be careful about passing judgment on others. Know yourself. Distrust yourself. Recognize that we all have the same failings, just manifest in different ways. You see, Christianity is rotten. The problem with Christianity is Christians, because the problem with humanity is people. It's not just Christianity that starts wars or religion that starts wars. It's people who start wars. Guns don't kill people, in fact. People kill people. Problem with atheism is people. Problem with atheism is atheists. Problem with Buddhism is all the Buddhists in it. The problem with Christianity is the Christians in it, because the problem with humanity is that all of us are hypocrites. All of us fail. All of us hurt others. All of us are cruel, violent, mean, nasty. We all manipulate. We all have power plays. We all oppress. We are all dishonest. We are all cruel. You might have had awful experiences with Christians in particular, associated with church in particular. And that is awful. And for that I've tried to say a sorry as shallow as it might seem. You might have been appalled at reading about and hearing about the past, the track record of those who take the name of Christ. It might have been especially powerful for you, however, because it shattered your hopes and expectations about what Christians ought to be, or what humans ought to be. And so it really hurt, because it was a shocking betrayal. But you know what? The Bible teaches, Christianity teaches, the truth that all of us are flawed and sinful, that it ought not be a shock when we discover just how broken humans are. It ought to be a confirmation of the very nature of things. It's not right to reserve this rejection for Christianity alone, but we need to be suspicious of all people, all values, all politics, all religious views, all spiritual views, all communities. And again, as I began with, but Christianity teaches that this world isn't the end, but there is a day when God will actually right the wrongs of this world, and there is a comfort in that, that God will right the wrongs of the hypocrites, of the abusers, of the oppressors, of the genociders. And he will hold account the abusive priest just as much as he will the murderous drug dealer. And so there is a comfort in knowing that God will right the wrongs of this world. And more than that, we need to wrestle with the claim. Just at least wrestle with the claim. You might not believe that there is a God, but if you're going to analyse and argue about Christianity, you need at least to wrestle with the fact that it might be true there is a God, even if you don't like the idea and it seems silly to you. It might be true that there is a God. And if that's the case, Christianity is not simply the teachings of hypocritical humans. It's not simply the power play of hypocritical religious sinners or something, right? But it's actually, it might be there is a God, an And it might be that God is speaking through the Bible. And if that's the case, it needs to be heard despite the failings of those who take the name of Christ. The problem with Christianity is Christians. Well, the problem with humanity is people. Secondly, Christians are hypocrites. Therefore, in fact, Christianity is authentic. That's the second thing I want to try and raise with you. Christians are hypocrites, but I think for that very reason it shows that there is something authentic about Christianity. Because you see, Christians agree. That's what I'm trying to say. Christians agree with the fact that Christians are flawed. Christians are saying the same thing as the critics of Christianity at this point. Again, from the teaching of Jesus, again in Luke's gospel, Jesus tells this story about what it means to be right with God. Again, criticizing religious arrogance. This is Jesus' parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. In Luke's gospel, chapter 18, verse 9, it says, "To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, a religious man, and the other a tax collector, in that day a traitorous, unseemly type. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. 'God, I thank you, I'm not like other men, evildoers and robbers, adulterers, even like that tax collector over there. I fast twice a week, I give a tenth of all I get. So I'm good. I'm religiously, genuinely sincere and active.' The tax collector, however, stood at a distance. He wouldn't even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me, a sinner.' And this is what Jesus said, 'I tell you the truth, it's that man rather than the other.'" It's that man. The, "Have mercy on me, God. I'm not worthy. Have mercy on me." That man is the one who went home justified before God. "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted." The Christian religious claim is that all people, including Christians, are corrupt, are sinful, are guilty before God. All of us are guilty of distorting religion to our own ends and preferences, or our own philosophies, our own points of view, distorting them to our own convenience. Christianity is not naive. Other views, including some atheist views in the secular humanist camp, can be painfully naive about the essential goodness of humanity. And if only we had a few more freedoms and a little more education, humanity would be gloriously, wonderfully, lovely and free. That's naive. It's naive. Christianity is not naive. Indeed, Christians possibly have a large representative of the broken, the weak and the guilty. And so, within the Christian church, there are many like the tax collector in Jesus' parable who are admitting their flaws and have come from broken pasts and so have additional struggles in their moral life. They're not all together, and they're not able necessarily to all be totally cool and totally upstanding and totally impressive people, because they've recognized the need for God's mercy. And so you might look down on them and say, look at them, patchy lives, lame clothes, inconsistencies. Consider where they've come from. You see, Christianity is not claiming to gather the elite of the best, of the perfect, of the most pure. It's claiming to be the mercy of God to those who need it. You see, that's because the authenticity of Christianity is not about keeping up appearances, not about competing, impressing, pretending, being perfect. That when Christianity becomes like that, it is inauthentic, it is flawed Christianity. It's Christianity that lost its way. Authentic Christianity admits its failings rather than pretends to perfection. True Christian sainthood, in the biblical sense, is a person saying, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner," rather than the person saying, "Look at my wonderful good deeds and how perfect I am." Genuine Christianity, and my experience, this is the case, genuine Christianity is down to earth, vulnerable, broken, and honest. And it's a relief to discover that, the thought that it's possible to be okay in life and to be okay for life after death because of the mercy of God and not because I've got it all together. Because at the heart of the message of Christianity is grace. And grace means compassion and mercy, generosity to the undeserving. Grace means God favours those who ask for mercy and forgiveness. It's a gift, rather than God favours those who go on the right pilgrimage, say the right prayers, do the right washings, attend the correct feasts. That's not Christianity. often, like in grade 12, you might do studies in religion. And in order to just kind of make it easier for those who write the textbooks, they just bung all religions together. You know, Hinduism has these rituals, these priests, these teaching, this morality. Buddhism has these rituals, these teaching, this. And Christianity, well, some versions of it, don't they? You know, the Orthodox and the Catholic, they have those religions, those hats, those teaching, those feasts, and just like everybody else. But that's a gross misunderstanding of Christianity, actually. It's a misrepresentation of authentic Christianity, historic Christianity. Historic Christianity is not about moral code, religious hierarchy, religious ritual, but it's about the mercy of God to guilty sinners. In that sense, Christianity stands out amongst world religions and ought to be treated as a distinct type of teaching. The message of the gospel is mercy to sinners, undeserved mercy to sinners. That's the message of the gospel to you. That's why Christians are so keen on it. They're not saying, why can't you be gooder like we are, daggier like we are, nicer like we are, churchier like we are. Christians are saying, we've found out that God is giving tickets to heaven for free, and we want to offer you one. The invitation of Jesus Christ is to anyone that they can go to heaven, be sure of their entry into heaven by the mercy of God, sealed through the death of Jesus. So the authenticity of Christianity. Christians are hypocrites, therefore Christianity is authentic. Thirdly, I want to just consider briefly the track record of Christians. Okay, so I'm just going to look, we can argue forever about this, and you probably will want to in question time. There are pros and cons, sins and successes. It's a complicated business, this kind of stuff, right? You know, there are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics. We could go back and forth because we'll all have our own way of dismissing this or proving this. It's complicated. So let me just give you four things to bear in mind before I give the track record. One, beware of historical blindness. Ideas and cultures evolve and change. Even atheists of 100 years ago, Dawkins points out in his book on the God delusion, atheists 100 years ago espoused all sorts of shocking beliefs, racist beliefs. People always, and people look back on our day and be shocked at our narrow-mindedness in our day. Beware of historical blindness. I've just recently been reading Winston Churchill's History of the British People. And this is him commenting on the Middle Ages and an act of diplomacy that took place under the reign of Henry II. And he makes that same observation. So he's writing during the time of kind of World War II. And he says, it's a proof of the quality of the age. This is back in the 12th century he's talking about. It's a proof of the quality of that age that these fierce contentions shaking the souls of men should have been so rigorously and yet so evenly fought out. In other words, they were wise and peaceable in the middle of difficult conflicts. Then Churchill says, in modern conflicts and revolutions in some great states, bishops and archbishops have been sent by droves to concentration camps or pistoled in the nape of the neck in the well-warmed, brilliantly lit corridors of a prison. What claim have we to vaunt a superior civilization to Henry II's time? We are sunk in a barbarism all the deeper because it is tolerated by moral lethargy and covered with a veneer of scientific conveniences. And that was written in 1939. Beware of historical blindness. Secondly, before we go into the track record, separate out movements from institutions. Separate out ideals from labels. This is where I think Dawkins and a lot of the new atheists get it kind of wrong. What they do is they pick Christianity at its most institutional and its most generic in terms of label, and then finds the wackiest, worst, most atrocious examples of anyone who claims the label Christian or is a part of the institution called church, and often the Roman Catholic Church, right? And then says, look, see, Christianity sucks, but when we evaluate atheism, let's take the most dynamic movement thinkers who live up to the most pristine ideal of secular humanism and look how wonderful they are. And it's not really a fair comparison at that point. You know, when Stalin or Hitler is criticised, he goes, well, I know technically they might have said they're atheists, but maybe they weren't anyway, and that's not the case, that's not fair anyway. No, either we should compare institutions to institutions, or, and this is what I suggest, we ought to compare Christianity, its most vibrant, movement-like and idealistic, to atheism or Buddhism or whatever else at its most vibrant, authentic, idealized. Do you see what the point I'm making there? You've got to compare apples with apples and oranges with oranges at that point. Thirdly, all of us assess good deeds in the context of what we already think, right? If I don't like Aaron, then even if he's nice, if he irritates me, I'm going to say, yeah, but he's annoying, isn't he? Like, yeah, I know, but I know he lent me stacks of money, but he did it with that smile on his face. You know what I mean? And we can all tend to do that. We go, yeah, I know, but we all will assess things within the grid of what counts and doesn't count. We'll read into motives. We'll evaluate things within our own context and grid. And a fourth point is, Christian good deeds are in general praised and focused on the personal and the familial, not the governmental. If you read the Bible, the focus on Christian good deeds is personal relationships, family relationships, church relationships, not governmental and societal. When Christians wrestle with government and society, they're wrestling with stuff that is speculation that stretches beyond the direct teaching of Scripture. And so it can be a bit of a red herring to argue about Christian civil and social successes and failures. But anyway, enough of that. Let me give you some of the track record, five things from the track record, and then I'll reflect on Christian lives today. Five things from the track record. Firstly, the early church. How did the early church grow? It did not grow as, for example, Islam grew. It did not grow as Islam did, through war. Christianity grew through conversion, and it was only many hundreds of years later, after roughly 50% of the Roman Empire had become Christianized, that then the Roman Emperor Constantine converted. Christianity grew as a grassroots movement, not by sword, not by force, but by conversion. Sociologist Rodney Stark, in his book, The Rise of Christianity, analyzes this from a sociological point of view and explores how the treatment of women, the treatment of children, the acts of charity, just the sheer fact that Christians would stay and look after the dead, after the suffering and dying during plagues, whereas the pagan priests would just run away and leave them. Doctors could testify to the basic acts of nursing can have an amazing effect on people suffering illness. Just caring for someone, even if you don't know about modern medicine, can make a great deal. So the fact that Christians just stay there and, you know, stroked the people on the forehead and things, gave them a drink of water, nursed them, meant that Christianity grew in part because they survived and because they became attractive and because things began to be written like this. This is Emperor Julian writing to a high priest in the 4th century. Their moral character, the Christian's moral character, even if pretended, has led to their growth by their benevolence towards strangers and care for the graves of the dead. And then he writes to another priest, I think that when the poor happen to be neglected and overlooked by our pagan priests, those impious Galileans, meaning Christians, those Christians noticed that we weren't looking after our poor, and so they looked after our poor as well. The impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well, and everyone can see that we are not helping them. And so he tried to kind of, after the fact, institute social welfare to stop people from converting to Christianity. Rodney Stark's conclusion is, Christianity revitalized life in the Greco-Roman cities by providing a new norms and new kinds of social relationships able to cope with many urgent urban problems. To cities filled with the homeless and impoverished, Christianity offered charity as well as hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis for attachment. To cities filled with orphans and widows, Christianity provided a new and expanded sense of family. To cities torn by violent ethnic strife, Christianity offered a new basis for social solidarity. And to cities facing epidemics, fires and earthquakes, Christianity offered effective nursing services. So that's a pretty striking track record, for what it's worth. Second example, in the Middle Ages, dark and mixed times, right? It's not for any reason that people often refer to them as the Dark Ages. They were pretty fierce, nasty times, though I've discovered reading Winston Churchill's book. However, at its best, the church, even through the Middle Ages, were places where learning was recorded, promoted and encouraged. Learning and study and culture were promoted and encouraged, where charity was practiced, even in wild, tribal, barbarous times, and where the government was restrained. And we must see the church's role in the creation of, in the end, things like the Magna Carta, constitutional monarchy, and rule of law that restrains unchecked sovereign government, for what it's worth. Third example, the abolition of slavery and the many other inventions of the 18th century revivals in England and America. Astonishing time. England was and America were all but unchristian by the start of the 18th century, and yet during extraordinary revivals, they brought not only masses of converts in both England, Wales, Scotland, and America, but also a massive revolution of society. The most striking being the story of William Wilberforce, who over many decades worked for the abolition of the slave trade, not to mention the establishment of many orphanages, labour unions, which were at that time genuinely recognised to be a valuable thing, whatever your politics is today. Christianity had a remarkable effect in the 18th century. Fourth example, education and charity throughout the world. The mixed record of missionaries, especially the dark days in South America and the Roman Catholic Church there, is appalling. But that is not to overlook the fact that in many places Christians were restraining the abuses of colonialisation by protecting the indigenous, educating and providing charity. Where Christians go, schools are established, hospitals are built. And fifth, today, women's rights and social stability. Many people are acknowledging, again, for whatever flaws there might be, that in the third world today, Christianity provides an alternative system of social welfare, and its emphasis on the value of the home life has caused what one writer describes as the reformation of the machismo, where, for example, in many African cultures, it becomes, under Christianity, a macho thing to look after your wife and kids rather than go out and spend all your money on gambling and booze. And so actually women are cared for and uplifted by the Christian emphasis on the value, the macho value of domesticity. In his book, The Next Christendom, describing the growth, the rapid, massive growth of Christianity in the southern world, he writes, "As in matters of race, Christianity is far more than an opium of the Christianized of the disinherited masses. Christianity provides a very practical setting in which they can improve their daily lives. To be a member of an active Christian church today might well bring more tangible benefits than being a citizen of Nigeria or Peru." There's a track record for what it's worth, and you can pick that up and bounce that around during question time if you like. And then last of all, what do we make of changed lives today? Jesus says in Matthew 5 to his disciples, "Let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven." He clearly taught that although Christianity is about mercy to sinners, it will lead to a changed life. And you should be able to notice it. You should be able to look at Hendo and go, "Wow, you know, I should check out this Christianity thing because of Will's life." Look at Lucas. Just look at Lucas's hair and you'll feel, you know, profoundly transformed. No, but you should be able to look at Christians in some sense and be provoked to want to find out more about Christianity. However, yet again, bear in mind, we all read actions and behaviours in context. What counts and what doesn't count? You know, we'll all write certain things off. That doesn't count. If we want to, we can write anything off, right? We're all good at that. We can all be, "My pop smoked until he was 85 and was fit as a fiddle until the day he dropped dead." You know, "I'm right smoking." We can all do that, right? We can all do that kind of thing. "I think some guy kind of somewhere maybe paid off by the oil companies said that maybe global warming's not real. I'm pretty sure." You know, that kind of thing. We can do that, right? We can find what we want to find. So we've got to beware of that. And some of us are aggro and we are angry about church, and so we will find faults with the Christians in our lives. Yeah? Okay, so bear that in mind. Bear in mind also we are, as I've already said, dealing with people who are claiming to be forgiven sinners, who are saying, "I am a hypocrite. I'm a forgiven hypocrite. And I'm working on it." Each person, or country for that matter, or era of history for that matter, is starting from a different point. You need to see that person without the gospel, if you know what I mean. Rather than saying, "Well, he's a Christian, and I'm not a Christian, I'm better than him." A better question is, what was he like before he was a Christian? And what would you be like if you were a Christian? Do you see what I'm saying? You've got to be careful about, again, you know, seeing the starting points, the benefits of your background, your history, your context. And look for progress and struggle, not perfection. Struggles in the Christian life, speaking from personal experience, are sometimes small progress, lifelong struggles, not always dramatic, absolute, you know, "I killed a man and now I'm a Christian preacher," or something, you know. Often they can be the gradual ongoing struggles of a person wrestling with issues in their lives. And look for that struggle and progress. And don't underestimate how challenging some social and personal sins might be. Some societies and cultures can bring out the worst in best people. Some illnesses and psychological conditions can bring out the worst in the best people. Extraordinary people are extraordinary despite being all too ordinary up close. Have you ever come up close to someone extraordinary? You looked up to their mind, their art, their something, you know. You get close to them and realize they are amazing. But gosh, they're also annoying and failed and crabby, flippant, blind in a certain area of their thinking. Have you had that experience yet? Do you know what I'm talking about there? You will. You'll get close enough to one of your idols eventually that you'll realize just how infuriatingly amazing they really are, and also kind of reassuringly disappointing they are as well. Extraordinary people are extraordinary despite being all too ordinary, and that's the same with spiritual and moral people. Extraordinary spiritual and moral people are extraordinary despite being all too ordinary up close. The Bible itself acknowledges this and speaks very bluntly and openly about the failings of its people, its churches, its disciples. Recognizes the genuine Christian life now as one of struggle and progress, not perfection. And yet the changed lives are there. Jesus said, let the light shine before men, and they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Watch them. Watch the Christians. I dare you. You've got a brilliant fishbowl here at Jane. You can stare at them all day long. That might be inappropriate in some particular times of the day. You can watch Christians live. Give it time. Watch them. Notice the way they treat you, treat other people, treat people different to themselves. Notice how they say sorry. Notice how they make peace. Notice how they are generous, thoughtful. Look at what it's like for someone to live with convictions and values, with a hope beyond this life, with a vibrant personal faith. Have a look at that. Watch the way they can be extraordinarily tolerant, hospitable, generous and loving. I know statistics are so hard to believe. I don't really like statistics, to be honest. I was G-chatting Alan and preparing this and going, should I even talk about statistics? And he goes, don't bother. And I said, that's what I thought too. So I didn't bother to get the statistics. But let me just rattle off ones that have passed through my inbox and Google Reader since I've been a Christian. I've read surveys and statistics, for how much you care, that have claimed that Christians, at least religious people, are often happier in general than the irreligious, tend to be more tolerant about who they're happy to live next door to than the irreligious. You know, that the Christian is actually happier to live next door to the Muslim, the drug dealer, the single mother, than the atheist. Christians tend to give on average more to charity, tend to be more faithful in marriage, and the religious tend to have better sex, more of it, and more orgasms. And Christians and religious people tend to live longer. Now, there's probably flaws in all those statistics, so, you know, I half believe them because I want to. You might half disbelieve them because you want to. But there you go. There are counter statistics, of course, additional factors, dismissal. We could play that game forever. It's one argument among many, and this is how I want to finish. You see, this whole question about Christian hypocrisy, we've got to wrestle with all of that. We've got to say sorry for the things we do wrong, absolutely. But this is one argument amongst the much larger question of who on earth was Jesus? This is one of the larger questions of where did this world come from, really? Even if you are convinced about the process of evolution, sure, some Christians are too. But what kicked it all off? Where did the universe come from? How did life enter into this world? In the context of the message itself, the message of the gospel of Jesus, the existence of God, his teaching, his death, his resurrection, his promised return, in that context, that's how you analyse the Christian life. And you're not really in a position to point fingers at what you think might be the flaws in the Christians around you if you're not also seeing the context in which they live and examining the person of Jesus for yourself. What do you make of Jesus? What do you make of God's claims about Jesus? There are serious investigations to be done there that ought to be done. And what better time than while you are studying at a tertiary institution, studying some of you, at a tertiary institution and devoting your time to learning and to becoming the leaders of the future. What better time to investigate one of the most fundamental world religions and one that's fascinatingly unique in some ways amongst world religions. And since you've already bothered to come here, you've already self-selected yourself in as someone who may as well start with Christianity. Why? Because you're already here at some Christian thing, and I say so. Why not check it out? Read the Gospels if you haven't. Investigate some of its claims. Look further. And argue every step of the way, of course. Think it through, wrestle it. And as you do that, watch the Christians around you. Watch them. And all the Christians are going, eek. I'm going to finish there. Just take a minute to collect your thoughts and mumble and mutter at the people nearby you if you like. Go and grab a drink or more cheddar cheese. And in just 1 or 2 minutes, if you want to stick around, I'm happy to take some questions. If you want to bail, that's totally fine as well. We will have some green buckets sitting out on the back table whenever you do choose to head out. So if you want to leave comments on a piece of paper and drop in the green buckets, you can do that. There's also these postcards that list our regular meetings. We've got 2 more evening sessions before the end of the year, so you're welcome to come along to those as well. All right, well, if people want to throw up their hands and ask any questions, you're very welcome to do so. And to some extent, your question might be someone else's question, so you being brave enough to ask the question might be doing someone else a big favour. You know what I mean? So how about that? There's a good deed right there. What's up with the Crusades? Look, the Crusades is an example of the church mass sponsoring big, macho, heroic, romantic adventure, right? And the church really did bang the drum for it, and there were occasions of real excesses in the soldiers of the Crusades. That's not to be denied. What needs to be acknowledged, however, in the whole story of the Crusades is that we were dealing with a season of history where the fear and the aggression of the Muslim empires of that day were severe. And so we just got to bear that in mind in context, in terms of the aggression, the ferocity, and the expansion of the Muslim empires in the East during those times. They were quite severe. And so, although it doesn't justify the degree to which the church sponsored and triumphed over the course of the Crusades, or, again, in reading Winston Churchill's book, Richard the Lionheart, you know, like, good guy in Robin Hood who's away and then comes back, and in the cartoon he's like this jolly lion. Apparently he was basically not a very good king. He just liked fighting wars. And so he was away that entire time just kind of being awesome, fighting wars, when he really should have just looked after his country that was having a miserable time under, you know, Sheriff of Nottingham and Prince John and all that stuff. So he wasn't really all that lion-hearted. It's just everyone wanted him to be. It was one of those triumphant kind of advertising campaigns. He just had a great brand. So, look, the Crusades is an example of a Christian world which really had adopted that as the state religion, which is just open to certain flaws. And one of those is the marshalling of the institutional church for political ends. However, in context, we need to bear in mind that we were dealing with this kind of massive social instability and extreme aggression from the Muslim empires, and so that's the qualifying factors in the Crusades. Yeah, yeah. What was that? Look, I don't know about that particular occasion, but yeah, look, again, there are these sort of situations where, especially when the church gets bound too closely with civil government, it's liable to corruption because people are liable to corruption because power corrupts. And so, again, we need to bear in mind that, we are living in a very new world, which is the world, really post-World War II, which is the world of kind of international law and a desire to actually pursue diplomacy on this kind of global scale. And, you know, we're living in a world where that is just common sense, but that's actually quite new social technology in that full sense. And previously, just in world history, most of the time, war was to some extent a significant amount of self-defense as well. And that doesn't fully justify the extremes of it, again, let alone the spiritualizing of it, so the church sponsoring of it. But we do need to just bear that in mind, that we're dealing with a different world where everyone was attacking, plaguing, raping, and pillaging everyone else. And so war really did play an important role. And an important role in terms of protection, and in that sense, good deeds even. you know, protecting, you know, communities and families. So it's a complicated one, and the church sponsoring it in an extreme way is shocking. Yeah. What's worst is when at certain times the Roman Catholic Church has really encouraged a conversion by force, which may well be like what you're referring to in the south of France. It definitely was the case often in South America. And that kind of teaching is just not Christian. It's just simply unchristian at that point. At that point, in converting the pagans, the church itself would become pagan. And so that's at that point, Christians go, yeah, and God will judge that just as much as he'll judge the pagans, you know. So I guess that really needs to be recognized. And maybe it's worth saying, for what it's worth, that the 16th century was a time when there was a massive movement to dissociate Christianity from the Roman Catholic Church. And so when you hear the terms Catholic and Protestant, what you're dealing with Catholic is those who maintain continuity with the worldwide institutional Roman Catholic Church, with the popes and the cardinals and so on. But the 16th century Reformation was a time when there was a mass removal from that, and the Protestants were those who said, this has become bloated and corrupt, and this whole system of infallible, of popes and of the structures of the Catholic Church, they're just not biblical. And I and the Uni Fellowship sit in that Protestant camp, separating ourselves from what I'd see as the extremes and the abuses that come out of the Roman Catholic Church. So that's worth saying as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Protestants are partly to blame, but then capitalism has a lot of good things going for it too, you know. So I think unchecked capitalism is a pretty shocking thing, and we've seen it kind of trip over itself and its greed in the last couple of years, right, with the global financial crisis. But there are some things about capitalism which are terrific, and again, contrasting it to the extremes of communism, you know, capitalism is quite nice, you know, some of the powers of capitalism is it does say that people are equal, in the sense that each person is able by their own hard work to pursue freedom, rather than you're poor, your mum was poor, your kids will be poor, you should always be poor, and that's where you belong. You're rich, your mum was rich, your kids will be rich, and that's where you belong. You know, whereas capitalism says, well, if the rich is dumb, they can get poor, and if the poor works hard, they can get rich. And so that's the good thing about capitalism, is there is an equality in it, which is terrific, you know. And its ability to generate efficiency and push up things, you know, science and capitalism combined, I think, generated some of the increases in agricultural productivity that have really saved the third world in the 20th century, you know what I mean? So capitalism has its strengths, and I think Christianity has contributed to that. Capitalism has also got its massive weaknesses when unchecked. And I think Christianity rightly should check capitalism, you know, at those extremes. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the deal with groups like the Australian Christian Lobby and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Christian ideals in an obviously post-Christian society where people
What groups like that are trying to do is they believe, at the very least they believe, that what the Bible says is good and right, and so is good for people. And so if they try and encourage what the Bible teaches in the structures of our society, that will be good for people. So that's at least the intention. The Australian Christian Lobby, I think, beyond that, may also have to some extent a sense that at least historically, Australia has come from a more Christian civilization, Christian heritage, and sees that as being some of the things that hang our kind of history and our nation together, and so they want to perhaps preserve that to some extent or uphold that. And so that they're bringing that to play as well, a certain interest in a kind of heritage about what it means to be Australian. And to be honest, everyone is arguing about that, right? You know, everyone in the world seems is arguing about what it means to be French, what it means to be British, what it means to be American, what it means to be Australian. Everyone's got their opinions. And I don't think anyone could come up with a solution that everyone will be happy with. You know, so that is the challenge of living in the universe where people disagree with you. And so the Australian Christian Lobby, I'm not sure if I 100% agree with all the things they say or all the battles they fight, to be honest. But at least they're trying to say, if we introduce some of these laws that represent Christian values, that will be good. In general, it'll be a good deed for people. That's what they're wanting to do, whether you like agree with them or not. And also, our nation has this heritage, and preserving something of that will provide some ongoing stability for the nation, whether you agree with that. But I think that's the kind of thing they're trying to do. Yeah, I tend to be sort of try and keep a step back from politics and political lobbying, just because I think it's very hard for Christians to do it very well, actually. And those kind of pressure groups just sound, I think, to those who aren't Christians, like Christians are trying to tell us how we ought to live. That's just not a good look, you know. So, but that's just where I lean. You know, others, as I say, for very good reasons, might try to have a different voice. Was there another question, sorry? Yeah. Yes, I think that's true, that there are a whole bunch of things that can help improve ourselves, improve society. Religion, in general, can often do that. Not all religions can. Some religions are generally pretty destructive, you know. And it doesn't need to be only religion. Other things can be really helpful, you know. How many movies are there about, you know, the teacher that goes into the slum school and teaches them to ballroom dance, or teaches them to skateboard, or teaches them to something, play gridiron, and that, you know. But that is true, because it unites people, gives them self-respect, gives them something to work towards, gives them a community to be a part of. All those things can be good, whether it's ballroom dancing or religion. That's true, and you could say that's all there is to it. You know what I mean? You could say that's all there is to it. I'm saying, no, there's more to it than that. But in the case of Christianity, we're not just dealing with one of these mechanisms of self-improvement, but we're dealing with something more. Yeah. And you might say, well, I don't agree with you. And I'm saying, well, I don't agree with you, and then you need to find some other things to marshal in favour of that the other. You might say, what's the long-term impact of those things? You might say, what's the motives that lie behind those things? You might say, what's the objective truth of those things? So, yeah. Yeah. It's got nothing to do with Christianity either way. Christianity is just kind of there, either case. You know, just in the photo, it's like Wally, you know. Here I am, in the Crusades, here I am, today, Noosa. That's right, yeah. So I think to some extent that is true, that there are some larger movements in society in general, I think, are very hard to be influenced by any one thing to a certain extent. You know what I mean? That culture is just so big, it's so complex, that it's very hard for anyone to take credit for the huge movements. And so to some extent, yeah, that's why I would want to zero in more on family, community, personal life, to some extent, rather than social cultural issues, because they are just so vast and complicated. However, I think, and what I tried to do with some of that track record stuff, is I think that you can say that at least at certain points, Christianity is one of the contributing factors to some of the good in society. Maybe not the only one, but one of the contributing factors. And so whether it's in the Middle Ages and some of the restraints at its best, you know, there's the worst cases like the Crusades, but there are also great cases where Christianity genuinely did restrain sovereign governments and restrain them, bless you, sustain them from the abuses of sovereign monarchy power, you know, and that's where the church was actually a really helpful restraining force. You could similarly, you know, say Christianity in part had an introduction to some of the goods of capitalism, but then also some of the goods of labour unions, which is more of a left-wing thing. Christianity had influence to do with the birth of science to some extent, it could be argued, in the 17th century. So you can show the contributing factors of those things. So I guess teasing out both sides, say it's not a knockdown argument that Christians can get smug about, but nor is it that Christianity has no impact. It sits somewhere in between. Absolutely, yeah. More oppressive or covering. Absolutely, it is. But the difference is it's not, that's right. It's not human. It's not, and I guess that's one of the freedoms of when you have an absolute truth beyond this world, you restrain the power of humans within this world. And in a funny way, sometimes extreme pluralism can actually promote a certain kind of cultural oppression, because since there is no absolute truth, how do we decide what society should do? Well, the powerful decide, because since there is no sovereign beyond this world, and since every truth is true, how do we decide which truth wins? Well, it's everyone has the most money, the most muscle, or whatever. So in a sense, yeah, that's exactly right. It's actually that greater sovereign that isn't a human flawed sovereign, that's the thing that actually checks and restrains. And the danger is when the church itself gives its cardinals or its bishops or its popes or its you know, evangelical ministers, megachurch ministers, gives them too much of a voice of God power, you know, rather than them going, actually, I'm just a servant of God and I myself can be fallible. Yeah, and so that's often when it goes wrong. Great that so many of you rocked up tonight, and you're more than welcome to, as I said, you can grab us on, find us on Facebook and comment and stuff there. You can leave notes, there'll be green buckets as you leave in the table just in the foyer there. You can whack them there, you can come talk to me personally, let me know if you want to be on our monthly emails, come and check us out down the Fine Arts School next Thursday, and then the Thursday during swap back if you want to hear me again. But otherwise, Join Hendo at the normal Thursday night Jane Bible study. There's a whole bunch of options for what's next, but for tonight, we're done. So I release you.